It occurred to me that the day of the Ascension might be a good time to talk about the nature of man. When the angel said, "Why do you stand looking up into heaven?" Now, that question, of course, in the in the context of what the angel was saying, was not to say, well, it's useless looking up into heaven, but the conclusion was that he who ascended would return, so that the transcendent, that is looking up to find the clue to our existence and to the meaning of life, was not a futile thing. In fact, it was the significant clue to what life was about on the earth, and a significant clue to who we are as people. The question is asked, however, in a different context for the most part. Why do you bother with the transcendent at all? You can't measure it, you can't prove it, there's no way to verify it, and therefore the only sensible thing is to be concerned, thank you, concerned about the horizontal and not the vertical, the immanent instead of the transcendent. There's nothing up there, let's say, or if there is something up there, that is, if there is a God at all, there's no way to discover what anything about him, really. And therefore, just forget about it. Some time ago, well, many years ago, I read Sorokin's book on the crisis of our age. I think I was in college when I read it, and then it reappeared about 5 years ago in paperback with a new foreword. Sorokin, an eminent sociologist from Harvard, who fled the Soviets, or fled the Bolshevists, in 1917 and came to the University of Minnesota as a professor of sociology, and was there about 7 years when Harvard invited him, and he became, I suppose, in many ways the most eminent of the sociologists for a quarter of a century. In his book, The Crisis of the Age, he points out that at the time of the Renaissance, or before the Renaissance, the Western world took very seriously the fact that man was a child of God. He belonged to a celestial regime. He was here as a temporary inhabitant, but he belonged elsewhere. I'm but a stranger here. Heaven is my home. This motif. And Sorokin points out that at that time, or the pre-Renaissance and the first part of the Renaissance period anyway, almost all of art reflected this, that if the painter went to work, he used as subjects the angels, the saints, and the sculptor the same way, the musician produced the oratorios and the glorias and the Kyrie eleisons. The student of law dealt with the moral law, or the universal law, or the laws of equity, implying that that was a transcendent thing. The family was regarded as an eternal institution, one that you couldn't dissolve once it had been sanctioned by the celestial regime. Man was therefore identified with God, the angels and the archangels, and all the company of heaven. Then the Renaissance rediscovered the Greeks and the Latins and brought into the picture a different definition of man, that man was a child of nature. He wasn't a child of God, essentially, because after all that you couldn't identify very well, and you had to deal in kind of a fantasy world if you were going to talk about God. But man was a child of nature. After all, if you observed him, you observed that he ate as other animals ate. He procreated as other animals reproduced. He needed shelter and clothing and the protection as other animals did. And even though at that time you didn't have chemistry and biology and these sciences to identify us as we now have, the weight came down heavily on man being a child of nature. Therefore, he had certain natural needs and natural rights. Because he needed to eat, he had a right to eat. Because he needed to procreate, to keep the race going, he had a right to this. And his rights were dictated not from a transcendent dimension, but from a horizontal dimension. And man was not a soul or a spirit. He was obviously a body, primarily, with bodily needs. And Sorokin says, we developed then into a sensate society. And for 600 years, we have become more and more sensate. As our lives have been focused on these needs that are primarily sensate needs of the senses. Therefore, we lost the transcendent dimension. Then he points out that gradually art no longer dealt with the celestial, but art now began to deal with the sensate world, until at the present time, while art at that time, 600 years ago, probably 95% at least, he said, of art was focused on man as a heavenly creature. Now, a complete reversal, he said about 95% of art is dedicated to advertising. And advertising is focused on, you know, the physical almost exclusively. Now he also points out that this is probably running amok. Now that's the note of hope in his book. He says that finally it gives way to violence of a great dimension, and that in fiction and drama and in other ways, man, the hero becomes the pathological person, and not the person who has these qualities that we normally call spiritual qualities. And he says that we're at the brink of a great turn, and if the world can be spared catastrophe for another 25 or 50 years, he said there might be hope of a rather worldwide reawakening to the spiritual dimension of man. But the fact is that there are all kinds of evidence, as Sorokin points out, and as we know, where the world is, and the Western world, the world as a whole, absorbed in defining man in terms of nature, and therefore identifying man with other creatures in nature. And if we want to know about man, therefore, we have to study his cousins. If you want to know what's going to happen to me under certain circumstances, you study the guinea pig or the rat or one of my lower cousins, and then you conclude that because the cousins react this way under those circumstances, under the same circumstances, I, Mr. Rogers, will react the same way. Now, obviously, that scientific study of man has yielded great benefits. And I would, in defense of the Renaissance and what it did for us, I certainly would conclude that for man to always be looking up and not looking around, depreciating his natural needs, and what God has put into him as a creature of nature, had its bad effects, and concentrating on man as a creature of nature has had its good effects. But to forget that a person is a spirit or a soul or has this dimension is, Sorokin says, ultimately disastrous, because it leads only to collapse. I think it must be the devil's plot to make us forget or deny that we are children of God. But almost all our educational work in psychology, in sociology, in economics, and in political science, all scientific effort in those fields will have to presuppose that man is a child of nature. And in a very subtle way, presuppose that he is not free. He's no more free than the rat. He's no more free than the dog. He doesn't make decisions. He is a composite of drives like his lower cousins. And these drives, as long as that's all he is, these drives provide a kind of predictable quality. Now, there's no point being scientific about something you can't measure or predict. That is, supposing in chemistry there was a capricious element so that hydrogen chloride would willy-nilly decide to become something else by morning, so that when the scientist comes back to experiment, he just doesn't know what's in the laboratory because this unpredictable factor is there. Now, in science, you can't tolerate an unpredictable thing, a radical free element. The moment you put that in, there's no possibility of being scientific anymore. And therefore, I think you have to remember that while the psychologist and the sociologist and the political scientist and the economist, they're all trying to be as faithful and as honest as they can be in the discipline that they pursue. But they all have to work, really, with the predictable and not the unpredictable. And that which is the unpredictable is freedom. And there is no freedom in the animal world. The freedom inheres only in the creature to whom God gave the gift of freedom, the right of self-determination, the right to choose. He made man in his image, in the likeness of God, and that's the radical element that's in there. In consequence, I think that you're better off trying to find out what man is like by reading Dostoevsky, for instance, instead of Freud. Because Dostoevsky has this, he's the artist rather than the scientist, and Freud is the scientist. And in the final analysis, I think the findings of science about man will always be deficient at the critical point, which is to assert that man is self-determining and that something new can come into the picture that's unpredictable because of the exercise of this freedom. Now this, to describe man as a child of God with this predictable, unpredictable quality of freedom, in a very subtle way, the only place that that's allowed at least from the religious point of view, that that's allowed to be promulgated or proclaimed or taught is in the church, or the institutions of the church, or let's say private institutions, because when we formed the constitution of our country 200 years ago, we said that state and church would be separate, and the state would have no authority over or responsibility for the religious life of the nation. We wanted to do that voluntarily. Therefore, as educational institutions developed and more of them became state-supported, and our whole public educational system is largely supported by taxation, at least until you get to the higher educational level, where we've got church colleges and private institutions of learning, but for the most part, the elementary and the secondary schools are prohibited from saying anything other than that man is a child of nature, or if you will, that he's a cousin of the rat. If some teacher says that he's a child of God, he could be prosecuted. Because this is not, we decided that, and I'm glad we decided that. Because I don't think that institution or our antecedent countries from which most of us came have come, or our forebears, from England and the Scandinavians and Germany. In all those countries, the state took responsibility for telling the story, whether the teacher believed it or not. Was not that important. He had to tell the story, though. And in the curricula in Norway and Sweden and Denmark and Finland and Germany and England, the Bible is there, and the catechism, and the story is told, whether the teacher believes it or whether the students believe it. The story is told, after all. And a child will learn that from one point of view, at least, he is not just a cousin of the chimpanzee. He is a child of God, created in his image. I've often thought what a tremendous burden this places upon the voluntary part of our society, upon an institution like this, and all the congregations and the churches from which we come. If this point of view, that man is more than a child of nature, is to be told, it's up to the voluntary agencies or the institutions to tell it. And if we fail, who's going to pick it up? The government is prevented from picking it up. It's not likely that the communications media will decide it's their task, or the labor unions, or the Association of Manufacturers, or any of these, or the Kiwanis, or any of these, will decide that it's their mission to do it. The church has to do it. And if that's lost, then I think Sorokin is absolutely right. We are on the road to complete disaster, collapse. This story and the belief in the story that man is a self-determining being who can make choices, and in whom there can be change, unpredictable change, touched by God, who also is free. If that's not there, I don't know how in the world we can generate really any interest, even, in significant change. We degenerate into a kind of veterinary world where as long as my worth and my dignity and value is not a given thing, but as a part of the animal kingdom, then I can be treated ultimately like an animal too. Now, the leaven of the Christian faith has been so strong in the Western world that to think of Hitler killing 6 million Jews is just intolerable. We say, how in the world can it happen? But why can't it happen if human beings are simply a part of the animal family? If you have 100 head of cattle and 25 head of cattle, and you have food, or pasture or food for only 75 head, you sell 25 head of cattle. But you can't sell people. And if you can't take care of more than 75%, you get rid of the other 25%. Also, even some high, ethical statements like the greatest good for the greatest number, aside from being anchored in this Christian concept of man, becomes very manipulative. Hitler, I'm sure, said that these five million were not good for the herd. The greatest good for the greatest number, and the greatest number happened to be blue-eyed and flaxen-haired Nordics, whom Hitler believed were destined to take care of the world. As long as those 5 million Jews were threatening those 60 million flaxen-haired people, and they were threatening them in a sense, they were far out of ratio to their numbers. They were occupying places of importance, of power, and control. And this incensed Hitler that just a small part of the herd should be running the whole herd. So he decided to get rid of that part of the herd. And as long as your premises are veterinary, you can do that. And I suppose by the same token, Stalin got rid of this small landed society that he had. And I don't know how many millions were killed. I've seen figures of 20 millions that just killed because they were a threat to the organized structure of the new state. And what's happened in China, I don't know. There you read millions too who were dissenters and had to be gotten rid of because they were not good for the herd. And a veterinary society is easily adopted. I don't know what we would say in our country now. 1 million legalized abortions last year. And we have said in the highest court of the land that a mother has the right to determine whether this child shall live or not. Now that sounds, there are many things going for that statement, but press it a little farther and say, if the mother has the right, who else has the right? Society has the right, certainly. If you think in those terms, maybe overpopulation is a threat to the herd, And therefore, you just can't tolerate having so many new calves in the corral, and if you can't prevent their inception, you'll have to stop before the birth occurs, or as some rather progressive, so-called progressives have said, that probably the best thing to do is to wait until the child is born, and 3 days after the child is born, after you've taken all kinds of measurements to see whether that particular creature is going to be good for the herd, then you either let it live or don't let it live. Now the whole business is really a kind of accepting the notion that this person is a cousin, a very complicated cousin of the rat. The rat doesn't write oratorios and doesn't devise computers and all of this stuff, but after all, you have to conclude that in a family, some of the children are going to be smarter than others, and it happens that the Homo sapiens seem to be have a little edge on their lower cousins at the time. But I'm not sure what we face at this point in the whole of society, because. Could very well be that in a subtle way, and it's a subtle way, After all, when you think of the fact that from the time a kid goes to kindergarten or first grade until he finishes high school, at least in his school system, the only definition he has of man is this one, that he's identified with the mammals. He's identified with the organic life. There's nothing more that can be said for him than that. Now, obviously, we have some marvelous teachers in our public school systems and who in a more subtle way will certainly not yield to this point of view, but all the textbooks have to be like that, really. And what happens then to a society that the only place they hear that that's not quite true is in church? And just where are we going as a civilization? It certainly is evident that human life is not taken as seriously as I think it once was. We're not enraged by some of these things that we tolerate. Euthanasia is on the threshold, obviously. And when will the time come when the state, devising some system that looks civilized, will find a way to end the lives of people who no longer are productive and who in effect drain the economy of the country, and we can't afford any longer to have people live over 80 or over 70 or whatever it happens to be, because the tax structure won't take it. So as we have sort of bought in on the idea that man, after all, is a part of the mammal kingdom or the animal kingdom, we can move in that direction without being utterly offended. Now, I'm not sure. We might discuss that a bit. I've been concerned about our preoccupation with death on the one hand, which is new in a sense. When a publisher invited me to write something about death for young people, the publisher said, and I said, well, are they interested? And the publisher said, well, our research shows that young people are interested in two subjects, sex and death probably more than sex. And I thought back to my days when I was a teenager. I had the normal interest in sex, obviously, but I can't remember being absorbed in the question of death. But it's there. And our son Peter, I remember when we were driving together when he was about 12 or 13 and he and I were alone, and out of the blue he shook me by asking the question what chance I thought he and his friends had of living out a normal lifetime. And so I was aware of the fact that we were in a new period where the presence of death, preoccupation with death, was there at a higher level. And at the same time, and then I was told that suicides were more numerous among young people than probably any other class, and then I'm just appalled at what we're doing in the arms race, knowing what kind of suicidal instruments we've got. We keep saying we're number one, which means that we're going to be sure that we've got more destructive tools than anybody else. And when we know, as one of my cousins in the Air Force said, we talk about the two-hour war that may come. In 2 hours it would be over and nothing left. And yet we can talk about that and think about it and act this way with a certain calmness, as if, well, so what? Well, if we're no more than animals, so what? You know? But if we're children of God and have commission to take care of this planet and each other, then that's another ballgame. And if there's a veterinary society, if that's the point of view we take, then I think we end up eventually with veterinary values. I've told this several times. Several years ago, somebody called my attention to a question or in Dear Abby's column. A lady wrote and said, "I'm living with a man, not my husband. And now I discover that he's two-timing me. He's living also with another woman, not his wife. Shall I leave him or shall I stay by him?" And Dear Abby said, "As long as you insist on living by those standards, consult your veterinarian." Why not? But there's a frightening... I was talking with one of my friends who works in ethics, and we were on a program together, and he was obviously avoiding the term right and wrong. He was using the term an action or an act appropriate to the occasion or appropriate to the situation. And I said, we talked a little afterwards. We didn't have time to talk much. And I said, that bothers me that you don't want to use the term right or wrong, but use another phrase, the appropriate to the occasion or to the situation. And I thought afterwards, there's something here that I don't understand. If I've always thought that on the transcendent level, at least, you don't just function to do something that's appropriate, but you do something that's right, and you abstain from what's wrong, that you have that kind of language and that kind of orientation. Well, I'll come back to some of this, but if we define man as an animal, and we do in a great measure, there are four classifications normally that we use. First, that man is primarily an eating animal. He's an economic creature. His chief concern is to survive. Secondly, that man is a fighting animal. He's a political creature. More than survival, he wants power or prestige or preeminence. Third, that man is a mating animal. His drives are primarily sexual, and everything he does is a kind of sublimation of these powerful glandular drives that he's got. And the fourth is that he's unlike other animals, he is a thinking animal, but an animal still, a reasoning being. Now let's examine each of these and see how prevalent they are in society. The first, that what makes a person tick, really the predominant drive within him, is survival or eating, and that that his life is governed by economic factors more than by anything else. If you give him a full dinner pail and assure him that he can have a full dinner pail tomorrow too, he'll be nice. You can control him. He'll behave. He'll be happy. Because man does live by bread alone, after all. And take away his food for 36 hours. And all kinds of applause for him. But supposing somebody says that the new preacher who's come to town, probably the best speaker that's ever been in this town. Now that's a different business, because I've been a preacher for 5 years in this town, and I'm not about to join in that enthusiasm, and because I am competing somewhere.
At this point, the village power was off for about 10 minutes.
And then all kinds of applause for him. But supposing somebody says that the new preacher who's come to town, probably the best speaker that's ever been in this town. Now that's a different business, because I've been a preacher for 5 years in this town, and I'm not about to join in that enthusiasm. And because I am competing somewhere. Now, I think it's very important, and very important for the human being, to find something that he does maybe better than other people do. Whatever it happens to be. We had a friend in Mason City who had polio and was limited, and his legs were in trouble. But he developed a good deal of strength here, and he could, you know, he'd always want to do this with somebody because he had a strong arm. And he could take defeat, or he could take his delinquencies in other areas, or the fact that he couldn't compete in other areas, because in one area he could make it. And I've often said, if you can't make it in one way, you know, if you can't play tennis well, or if you can't do this well, maybe you can play checkers better than anybody else, or tiddlywinks, or something that would give you a little poise over against this competitive world. But we all are competitors, and you've had instances, you know, in courts where a person, in order to prove that he's right, will spend lavishly of his money. That is, he will regard security in second place in order to have the win the case, to show that he was right after all. I don't know who would be the key in a large measure for this, except maybe Darwin and the survival of the fittest. It isn't enough to survive. You've got to be the best survivor. Or a person may be making, let's say, $50,000 a year, and that should be enough to buy him food. But down the hall, in another office, one of his peers in the same profession is making $100,000 a year, and it bothers him no end, not because he can't buy bread, but because somehow money has become a criterion for preeminence, for being thought the best, anyway. Well, that's the second description, and you'd have to say that that's very much in evidence. And when you put that up in the higher categories, like somebody was saying that Hitler and Stalin too were almost ascetic in their wants, but were mad for power. They couldn't possibly countenance anybody having more power. And in small ways, we're all caught up with this. The third description, that man is primarily a mating animal, and you probably have to give Freud the front seat for this school, and you'd have to say that that's a very widespread acceptance too, that interpersonal relations between husband and wives in some schools of thought are dealt with almost entirely in the glandular field, that if there can't be a proper adjustment there, then that there's nothing left. And I remember during World War II reading in Liberty magazine an article which in effect said if Hitler had had a regular sex life, happily married, let's say, and his biological functions in good order, he would have been a nice guy and there wouldn't have been any World War II. You see? So all history, therefore, in this school would be traced back to the sublimations, these drives that are under the surface and that determine what people do. Well, the fourth, I don't think has been very widely accepted lately, that man is a reasoning animal. This was more widely accepted 100 years ago. And now we've been a bit disillusioned about man as a reasoning creature, and had And I think this also is a symptom of buying in on the animal identity, that man works from the gut reactions and not from his reasoning powers. And everything he does, he may throw a cloak of reason around it, rationalize it. And the more clever he is, and the more sophisticated he is, the more skilled he is in doing this. But underneath, he functions pretty much as a primitive. And whether he has any logical or dialectical abilities or not, that's quite beside the point. Now, once you've said that about us, and you've said a lot about all of us, who is there among us who doesn't have concern for security? Not very many. Now, it goes out of bounds too often, but it's there. And so the economic man, a person, is a part of all of us. And who is there among us who doesn't need some praise, or need acceptance, or have a chance once in a while to think that we may be a little better in certain areas than our peers? It's a need that people have, the need to achieve or whatever. And every mother or father, mothers particularly who work with the children maybe a little closer, knows this about their child and keeps building them up and tries in every honest way to do it. That's too bad to be dishonest about that and try to build up somebody when he obviously doesn't deserve to be built up. But there are good things that can be said for everybody. And maybe we ought to be more sensitive to that. And when somebody does something good, to say that to them. And you might go overboard a little on that side, rather than be so terribly taciturn about the other. I remember Mrs. Stavig, the president of Augustana College, when we lived in Sioux Falls. Her best singing days were probably over, but she was a good singer. And when she sang at a funeral for me, and I told her how nicely she had sung, she said, "Al, I know it isn't true, but say it again. Say it again." And everybody needs some of that. It's a part of our humanity. And obviously the mating instinct or the sex drives are tremendously important. And among other gifts, a gift of God. And I like to think that reasoning, the power of reason, is not scuttled or not lost among the chaotic primitive drives that each of us has. But when you've said that about us, you know, when you've said that's the kind of animal you are, and if that's all that's said, then almost all these drives, unless they be transposed, unless they come under the control or into the orbit or into the style of life of some other power, they can all be too destructive. So, having said all that about a person, and however high you elevate man, if you still keep him on the animal level, we have forgotten to say that which is the most significant thing about him, and that is that he's a child of God. He's created in God's image. However you account for that, and, you know, go back to Genesis or whatever, there's a decisive qualitative difference between my cousins on that side of the animal tree and me because I have the other part of my family tree. I have on one side these nice rats that have died for me in laboratories, and I ought to be deeply grateful to them. And to be haughty over against them, I think, is unchristian. Certainly it isn't nice when they've done so much for me. And I'm glad that the Lord, when he created me, did not throw away all the specifications and plans that he'd used on these lower cousins. He apparently thought he might as well use them over again. But if that's all that I am, and for I forget that I belong with the angels and the archangels and all the company of heaven, then I'm on the road to disaster, because I will join them. I will join this lower family, unless I'm conscious of another part of my family tree, that I am a child of God, qualitatively different from the other animals. I asked one of my boys one time when he was in high school, I said, how have you figured out that man came to be? Well, he thought a while and he said, well, I guess I thought that along the line somewhere, God took a creature and changed him into a man. Now, he was accommodating himself to this evolutionary hypothesis. He wasn't going back to clay, after all. He jumped a little ways away from clay and got up to, whether it was a chimpanzee or whatever, I don't know what he had in his mind. But the noteworthy thing was that there was a break in the continuity, and we weren't just like the others. There was a break in the flow, and God made us different, and gave us the right of self-determination. And the church, we will simply have to say, and say it over and over again, in the face of all evidence that can be adduced to the contrary, we have to say that the most important thing about us is that we were made by God for God, and that we're on the way to a full life with him after death. That there is this transcendent dimension, and that in the meantime, while we have responsibilities all over the place horizontally, if we don't have the ascension orientation and are aware constantly that we belong to a greater kingdom than just the planet, then we are in danger of being simply absorbed, conformed, and not being transforming in the society in which we live. We are children of God. We are eternal creatures. And if the planet blows, it's kind of, in the great plan of God, sort of an incident. But in the meantime, the only place we can serve him in the vertical, with the vertical orders or with the ascension commission, is down here, as taking care of the planet and taking care of each other. Well, I think I'll stop there for a minute you see, it makes a huge amount of difference. Some of you have read Edna Hong's Bright Valley of Love, the story of this Gunter, the retarded boy who was picked up by this fine institution and its leader, Bulgarin. And you had the vision in this institution of all these people who were non-productive, that they were princes and princesses in a royal kingdom. You couldn't treat them casually. And that when the pinch came and under the Nazi regime and the pressure, the economic pressure, if you will, of survival, survival of the fittest, or the greatest good for the greatest number. The government policy was to stop these people from eating, because food was needed to win the war. The way to stop them from eating was to relieve them of life, because they weren't productive. But if you haven't read the book, you must read the book. It's one of the... It's a great book. And you sense the chasm between the sensate world on the one hand, that Sorokin describes, and the world of the spirit, the world of God on the other hand. We talk a great deal about survival today, and think a great deal of survival, and it's very important. But I suppose when all is said and done, the accent in the Bible is not on survival. The accent is on having identity in this larger, or over here in this family tree, and not over here in this family tree. And we call ourselves pilgrims at times, and on the way home, and that home, in all its fullness, is on the other side of death, and not on this side. But if the only thing is survival, then I think, however well we get things ordered, it will be a kind of jungle. I remember the little verse I once memorized. For this is the law of the jungle, as old and as strong as the sky. And the wolf who keeps it may live, but the wolf who breaks it must die. Like the creeper that girdles the tree trunk, this law runneth forward and back. The strength of the wolf is the pack, and the strength of the pack is the wolf. We've got to survive together, and I've said this over and over again, that in this world that's gotten so interdependent, no part of it will be able long to survive by itself. So the girdle that girdles the tree trunk, the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack. And the pack now becomes 4 billions of people on the earth. But, and important as that is, because it's the only place we've got to take care of our brothers and sisters, and take care of and do the Lord's will at the time, is on the horizontal level, the esprit de corps to do anything, except in a very grim way, in the final analysis, of course, if we can't all survive together, maybe the United States can survive. And I remember when in the energy crunch, some 3 or 4 years ago, our president over television reassured us that by 1985 or whatever, the United States would be self-sufficient for energy. And I thought, what a terrible thing to imply that that's all that need concern us, is that we survive. And not that the rest of the world might survive too. I thought, what a marvelous opportunity he had at the time to become kind of prophetic for the whole world and to tell the United States that we are part of the family of nations, and we will do our best to make the kind of contribution for survival that the whole world needs. But if survival is the only thing that's going to push us, then in the pinch, survival becomes narrower and narrower and narrower, until in a grim way it's my survival rather than yours. One to one, even. That is within the context of the animal kingdom. Well, let me stop there. and you have some observations to make.
The problem that I was had been grappling with, and as I was listening to your lecture, was that in the Renaissance and with the whole issue of humanism and this type of thing, the problem wasn't so much that people saw themselves as a part of a lower order, but what I've always come to seem to think, at least, that the problem was that we became self-assertive. It's like Descartes, you know, I think, therefore I am. And we are the captains of our own ship. We don't need God. We are the transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not seeing ourselves, this way I've always been thinking, as part of a lower order, but that we are the ones who decide. And in that context, we can love one another. I'm talking humanism here.
Mm-hmm.
We can share with one another. We're not necessarily vicious creatures or that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, we can do good things and so on and so on. In other words, the lack of dependency that seems to come through.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the scary thing I see coming out of the Renaissance.
Yeah.
And this type of thinking. It's very subtle.
Yeah.
And it pervades our theology, or can pervade our theology.
Yeah.
Very subtly.
No, I think you're right, that in its finest expression of humanism, it was a noble, noble thing. And, as I indicated, this lack of concern, or let's say this absorption with the world up here, to the almost denial or neglect of the humanitarian needs, was a weakness, no question about it. This pre-Renaissance absorption with the celestial. But as you say, if I am not a dependent creature, that is, if we run our own show, we in the Christian family would say that's a denial of our basic nature, that we are dependent. I remember reading, was that Archibald MacLeish, I think, who had a little essay in Saturday Review entitled, Now We Are the Gods, and where he said that we'd given up belief in ghosts and gods and goddesses along the line, and now we'd pretty well, in the secular world, given up any serious notion of God at all. So we then become the gods. And in effect, he said in the essay that that's too much for us. We can't stand it. We can't stand to be that. We will fall apart. He didn't use the picture of a pilot and a co-pilot, let's say, of a plane. But it occurred to me when I read it that that might be an analogy too, that As the co-pilot, whatever weakness the analogy has, as a co-pilot, I function well if the pilot is sitting here. And he may not have to do anything with handling the craft, but he's there. But if that seat is empty and I'm left to do it alone, then something happens to me. I become, under stress, I get frozen, paralyzed, I panic, or whatever. That man is a dependent creature, and in order for him to function, that awareness of his dependency is his source of strength. But I think you're right that certainly the Renaissance, the finest of Greek culture, did not identify us with, it made a place for the human being over against the animal world. And maybe it's more in the wake of as the scientific study of man that we've gotten moved over toward the rat. But you know, it's kind of a frightening thing. I know there's an awful lot of truth in the psychologists and sociologists pursuing these analogies between what the rat does, even socially, if the rat has society, under stress to find out what we'll do under stress. But I don't know if you've had this feeling, but I have had a feeling that one of the terrible things that has happened to us is that just at the time when we reared this remarkable technological civilization and have so many achievements to our credit, we are at the point of selling ourselves short in a way that we haven't done for centuries in the Western world. And that this is a result of this finding our identity in some other place than with God or the transcendent. Wherever we find our identity. If I ask what does it mean to be human, and then I'm hunting all over among my lower cousins, that's one thing. But if I'm focusing on Jesus Christ, who came down to be human, and then ascended to lift humanity with him, that makes a vast difference in how I would identify myself as a human being.
So it comes back again, really, to the incarnation as the central focus.
Yeah.
Well, I think we can, the sun is shining, we ought to go outside.